So we'd like to welcome you all. And it's the title of this seminar is called "It's Living with Vows," and particularly an inside story, in the sense that all of us are living with vows, or to some extent more. So it's really our life. The idea of this seminar is also that we approach it from that angle. We're not just going to look at vows from a perspective of what the Bhagavad Gita says or what the Srimad Bhagavatam says. A little bit, certainly, we will take quotes from scriptures, because ultimately that is our main source of knowledge. That is the process. We follow a process based on scripture. But what I would like to do is I would like to look at ourselves like human beings. For once, I would like to step out of the uniform, out of the culture that we are in, and sort of look at ourselves as, where are we really in relationship to our vows as human beings? How do we really feel it? So the objective of this seminar is not so much to kind of establish what we should be following. I would say something about it, but particularly is, how is it to be following a life of vows? I'm beginning with a PowerPoint presentation. I have already one slide here on the screen, and you also have a handout which has the same frame of reference on it. This frame of reference is more or less the different angles from which we are going to deal with the topic of living with vows. We're looking at Shastra, and in terms of Shastra, I see that there are two levels of realization in the scripture. One is transcendence, and the other is the mode of goodness. And when we are related to vows, we can deal with them on two levels. We can deal with them on the level of transcendence, and then of course we are deeply absorbed in our Krishna consciousness and so on and so on. And then we work completely on inspiration, and the vows are just automatic. So then the vows are automatic, or in the mode of goodness, the vows are being followed more in the mode of duty, prescribed duty, on the basis of knowledge. We know that we have to follow, or we're trying, and so on. We're trying to get there. I'm looking at culture. Within the word culture, you will find the word cultivation, the concept of cultivation. So, culture means to bring out a particular mood, a particular consciousness, a particular style of behavior. But I'm not only looking at culture in terms of cultivation, and that is more generally the definition that devotees are looking at culture. Because Krishna Anushilanam, or cultivating Krishna consciousness. So we have a culture in Krishna consciousness which is outlined in the Nectar of Devotion, and describing to us the different types of devotional practices. But so we'll look at culture in that, for that angle, but we'll also look at culture in terms of a means to express desire. So a culture, a way that we will express our desire. And by doing that, we begin to relate more to the human side of ourselves, and we have that human side, and we need to live in a human way. In that way, Krishna consciousness becomes an experiment. Because we are in a unique situation. We live in the modern industrialized world. We have the Gaudiya Vaishnava culture, which is like grafted. It's like a, sometimes in a fruit tree you take a branch, you cut, and you just put a branch from another tree inside. This is called grafting in English. And you wrap a bandage around it, and eventually it grows into that tree and becomes part of the tree. So we basically are looking at the grafting of a branch into an existing tree. The tree hasn't changed. We are still living in the same world, the modern industrialized world, but within it we have our own little culture of whatever came across from Gaudiya Vaishnava culture. Like for example, you see in India, in Bengal, you see that in Mayapur, between us and our neighbors, the Gaudiya Bhats, who there are in their own environment, they are the Bengali Vaishnavas. Vaishnavism, Chaitanya Vaishnavism developed in their culture, and therefore it is mixed with their culture. There are many things which the Gaudiya Mat Vaishnavas are following and doing, which are totally normal for anybody else in Mayapur as well, or in the Navadvip region. Many standards of behavior are fasting on certain days, and all their cultural habits are very much intertwined with their normal, regular Vaishnava culture. So they look at us like with suspicion many times, because they see that we are not exactly adhering to that level of cultural behavior. So when we speak about Gaudiya Vaishnava culture, whatever I say, whatever we have absorbed of it, and eventually it is developed into something which is ISKCON culture. And whatever ISKCON culture is, I mean, you know better than I do. But sometimes it does occur that you meet someone in the street and they say, what's it like to live in a monastery? So when I think of a monastery, I think of monks that are walking in corridors while reading a book of prayers, very serious. And I don't know whatever an ISKCON temple is, but it's not a monastery, that's for sure. So we have our own ISKCON world, but then ISKCON has changed also many times. Like, I was thinking that maybe on one occasion in this seminar I should be wearing the head of a dinosaur. I thought I should put on a big dinosaur head and just sort of walk in here and say, I'm a survivor. I'm supposed to be extinct, but somehow or other I'm still here. I'm from the prehistoric era. Of course, there are dinosaurs or creatures that are from way before my time, and that belong even to another era. That may be, devotees have been starting since mid-60s. Mid-70s, mid-80s, mid-90s, and now in the new millennium. And in each time, ISKCON has gone through tremendous changes. Tremendous. The ISKCON we're looking at today is something very different from, well, whatever it looks like at its different stages of development. So, some of us have experiences of an ISKCON of an earlier era, ISKCON of a more modern era. In the earlier era of ISKCON, the institution was practically everything. The temple, life in the temple, life around the temple. Only in a later state did congregation become relevant, especially at the departure of Srila Prabhupada. Then there was the first what I call exodus in ISKCON. Mainly, many Prabhupada disciples began to feel suffocated under Dzogchenacharyas, who were absolute, and who started putting their disciples more and more in charge, and then many of the Prabhupada disciples felt obsolete, moved out, moved on, and some lived very Krishna conscious lives outside and became an alternative. Gradually, there was a shift of the, you could say, the point of gravity. And in one point, the gravity was in the temple. That's where the main center of gravity was. But in due course of time, the center of gravity moved out from the temple into the congregation, meaning that basically more devotees in the congregation than on the outside. So once there was a time when the devotees in the temple used to think the ones who live outside, they're basically off. They're basically fallen, they have problems, they are not really real devotees, they're sort of half-blooped, half-grown, whatever, and half-baked, and many other varieties of half. But then, in Dukkha's, after the shift of the center of gravity moved towards the congregation, and then the temple devotees, they were dysfunctional people who really couldn't like fit into society, fanatics, mental cases, who just basically, you feel sorry, you know, that there are such people, but anyway, we're glad that, you know, they found some shelter somewhere, and, you know, they're trying to become purified. Basically, they're not so bad, they're kind of nice, but you can't really, they're a bit weak, you know. Brahmacharis and other such species of temple devotees. So, in this way, the gravity center started to shift between institution and congregation. Therefore, my box is sort of following the traditional or the historical model or the historical hierarchy, ISKCON, institution, congregation. But if I was more high tech, I could make these boxes interchange all the time. Yeah, and because I don't know what ISKCON is. There was a time when we spoke of ISKCON and then the greater ISKCON, right? Meaning everything that's outside. And these days, it's very difficult to say where does ISKCON begin and where does ISKCON end. But anyway, we live in it. Good luck. We'll talk about it. Psychology is looked at these days because psychology is a means to connect with our deeper feelings, with our true self, at least true conditioned self, as it exists today. And in that way, we can sort of find a motivation which relates more to our true nature. Again, true nature, conditioned nature of the present. By which we hope that we can apply ourselves easier to the process. So this is mainly the reasoning by which we say, yes, psychology is very helpful. Whether it is or not, I'm not advocating it. I'm putting a question mark. We are simply looking at it as something that is also to be considered. Psychology will also make a person aware of duty and desire, because one cannot only live according to desire. If we just live according to desire, then we'll do any damn thing that comes in our head without considering the consequences. So acting on, in considering consequences, and therefore sometimes controlling a desire and so on, relates to duty. Right? And therefore, psychology also deals, besides with motivation, with duty and desire. History, I am looking at different histories. I'm looking at the history of the world. I'm looking at the history of ISKCON, and I'm also looking a bit at the history of the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya that we are part of. So these are three types of history that I would like to look at. When I speak of the inauguration of the world history, I would like to begin with Christianity as like a major milestone in Western historical development. And after the initial days of Christianity coming up, it became institutionalized. The church was formed. Like, there's a quote from Kierkegaard which says that on one day Peter converted, baptized 3,000 people, 3,000 Christians he made in one day. And Kierkegaard says that is the day that Christianity died. Because it's not possible to actually change 3,000 people in one day and change their beliefs and to change their faith and to make them in their heart commit. So it became external from that day on. So a church institutionalized and no longer just all about the spirit of the personal transformation and total dedication, but more a sense of belonging to the club. There are chairs over here in the front. Four of them. Well, that's okay. You can walk away. I'm not sensitive to that. Or if you feel more comfortable, just get the chair and take it to the back. Yeah. So, yes, so the church formed, and we got a very autocratic era, an era with very strong authority, sometimes called a theocratic era, because we were dealing with church fathers, popes, cardinals, bishops, priests, and the likes. And basically, in those days, the church had the monopoly to the truth. And if you didn't agree, then for you there was the stake, or the ban, or some other variety like that. Therefore, in that era, I had to be very careful. If in that era I was too outspoken or too different, it was risky. You were risking your life. So it was a time to be careful. It was a time somewhat oppressive. It was a time which was followed somewhere. Never a clean cut, not from one day to the next, which was gradually followed by the Renaissance. The Renaissance rebirth is giving an era wherein, again, individual orientation came about. Where people began to, again, a little bit like in the Greek era, look at the world through their own personal ideas, their own personal values, and so on. So, in world history, this is as far as I want to enter into world history in general. I don't like to present that I can give an exhaustive or proper description of world history. I cannot. There are many who are much more learned than me in this regard. So, I'm not attempting. I'm sketching, and in the sketch, I'm only using certain relevant elements. But it's not entirely based on an idea of Dhammakarana Swami. I did base my line of reasoning on a book of a professor in English literature named Van Doren, who basically started to describe the mood and the psychology of people in the different eras. And when I read that, I thought, that's Iskon. That's us. Right? I just realized that we went through the autocratic era, and in the autocratic era, basically, you were not encouraged to have opinions. You were encouraged to surrender. You were encouraged to not to kind of speculate, but you were encouraged to accept what was bona fide and not question, simply accept it in parampara, and that's it. And beyond that, There is no investigation, because this is the truth, and if you are doubting it, then you have a problem, there's something wrong with you, and if that gets too serious, then maybe we have to look at your motivations. Are you envious? Maybe. That era lasted in Iskran for a particular period of time. We could say the inauguration around Srila Prabhupada. Gradually, Iskran became more and more institutionalized with time. Even in Prabhupada's presence, eventually, leaders became more and more in between the devotees and Prabhupada. They were strong leaders. After Prabhupada's departure, the leaders were very strong. We got the Solomacharyas, and the era where it was indeed very autocratic. And then, somewhere after that, started the Renaissance, and slowly the Renaissance is happening, and slowly devotees start to look for their own real experience, their personal experience, their experience of Krishna. In the autocratic era, what is the question? Is it bona fide or not? In the Renaissance, the question is not, is it bona fide or not? The question is it relevant to me? So now we are living the Renaissance, and the question is therefore, it's all got to be relevant to me. So these days, it doesn't matter at all when you say to someone like, oh, sorry, but you can't really do it. Why not? It says in the Poor Prabhupada's books, you can't really do it. And then, you come back and you're still doing it, Because it's got to be relevant. It has to be me. It has to be something I feel, something that makes sense. Like there was one boy standing in front of the school board, and the teacher is standing next to him. And it said, 5 and 7 is 11. So the teacher is standing there, like pointing at it, like 5 and 7 is 11. And the kid said, I know it's wrong, but it's how I feel. So it's like, that's sort of where we are. So I went through this frame of reference. We will look at vows from these various angles: Shastra, anthropology, sociology, psychology, and historical. Why not just from Shastra? Yes, so that we look at ourselves from the outside a little bit, and to see that maybe we are in many ways behaving like ordinary people, and that we're not so transcendental after all, that possibly we are still quite human, and therefore that we are, very much within all these categories that are described, behaving according to anthropology, sociology, psychology, history, or dealing with issues that are relevant in these categories. So I'm going to present a slideshow, and I pray it works, and you can pray with me. And because I'm not good at these things, I hate them. I hate operating machines. But this is the age where you have to,
the age of Kali,
you have to do it all yourself. So here I am, the operator as well. We're going to, let's see, I think it goes big. Right, now we have to set it up. Check. Right. So, the topic is living with vows, an inside story. We are looking again at the frame of reference. You keep this frame of reference in mind with this slideshow. The slideshow is not a systematic presentation of these different boxes, but rather the slideshow is more or less there to start our brains working, to crank up the little wheels that are there, that are a little rusty, and we haven't thought along these lines. So the only purpose of the slideshow is kind of to make us think, but to make it a little more exciting. We certainly open up for discussion while we're looking at the slides. And we'll see how long it will take us to go through them.
I'm sure there are many more, but I looked at
had some different vows that I saw in Srila Prabhupada's books when I researched however many times the word vow came up in Prabhupada's books. I looked at these quotes and I thought there are primary vows, initiation vows, and secondary vows, marriage. So one might wonder, well, why do I call initiation primary and marriage secondary? The reason is that it is in, I have here a quote actually, which maybe that's, it is a quote from Aquinas, so from a Christian religion. When therefore anyone vows something of his own to God, and does not vow something else of his own, it is a sacrifice. But when he vows to the Almighty God all that he has, all that he lives for, and all that is pleasurable, it is a holocaust. The word holocaust has different meanings, but basically the traditional meaning of the word holocaust is that it was used in relation to sacrificial fire. And then something was offered in a sacrificial fire and it was burned up completely. And the object that was offered was completely burned, then it was the holocaust. So we can basically say, yad karosi, yad asnasi, yad jalusi, yad asi, yad. So whatever you do, whatever we offer, whatever austerity we perform, all these kinds of things, whatever we eat, all that should be done as an offering to Krishna. That's really initiation. In other words, our whole life. When we give our whole life, that's the idea of initiation. Whereas marriage, we marry in Krishna consciousness, not just to entirely for Krishna alone, right? But we also marry because to regulate our own personal desires and so on. So therefore it is of secondary in nature. It's not only to surrender our life to Krishna, it's also for our own satisfaction. So therefore secondary. We also have unspoken vows that are very powerful. Absolute obedience to Guru is like something supposed to be very, very central in our whole life, and we never speak it out as a vow, but we totally live it. We live it for our whole life. We die for it almost. We just give up so much for that, just to serve. There are other unspoken vows, chastity for women. There are two ashrams which have no formal vows at all. Brahmachari Manaprastha, of course. We see that the great Acharyas, they also use vows as a way to further enhance their spiritual life. They take vows like Haridas Thakur, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, who both took a vow to chant 1 billion names. The English billion is somehow or other not the same as the European billion. The English mixed it up. They don't have milliard, right? So it's what we call milliard in European languages. And that comes to 300,000 names a day for 10 years. Or if you calculate 175 rounds a day for 10 years, what a vow. Even when you're sick or even, right, whatever, 175 rounds for 10 years. So those are the acharyas who, they can only do that on the strength of great inspiration, on the strength of love of God. Otherwise, how can you do it? On the strength of ecstasy. There are other vows like Kshetra Sannyas and so many more that I guess I got tired and didn't type in anymore. Supportive vows. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur sings Madhavatiti Bhakti Janami. From following the Madhavatitis, the appearance days of the Lord and so on, there bhakti is born. Ekadasi, fast days, Kartik Vrats, and so on. All kinds of vows that we're following. Yeah, like in every contract, there are the small letters.
And you don't really often think about them when you are entering into the agreement.
Right, what I wrote here on the board, it still needs some editing, actually, because I couldn't get my hands on the Iskon law book.
It's not easy to find these days.
Yeah? I don't know what to think of that. But if you go around and you say to someone, excuse me, do you have an Iskon law book?
It's not easy to find. You can download it from the web if you're really looking, but even that's not easy. You put it on Google and you look for Iskon law book and you'll have a hard time.
I've tried. Anyway, so by the absence of the law book, I haven't incorporated everything, but here come the questions. Yes, or comments.
Last time, 1020, what was
that? Huh?
The secretary's office in the manor.
The secretary's office in the manor, right. Yeah, a stack of them. Whoa, really, that's pretty good. And there are still places where it can be found. Now, I also have one on the Spanish farm where I have to deal with such things, but I'm not there now. So, basically, the contract that I am referring to here is referring to ISKCON, initiation in ISKCON, not only to initiation in the Goya Vaisu Sampradaya. So ISKCON is also written into the contract. Some of you may be reading, some of you may be too lazy to read the small letters. I don't know if I should read them out to you, but they are some points that I jotted down for someone who was eager to be initiated. And I said, well, are you sure? Yes, very sure. And then I sent back this list and I said, are you sure that you're ready for all of this? So there was some swallowing. And I'm not even sure if we are ready for all of this. And okay, 16 rounds daily at 4 ranks, no problem. Spiritual masters, direct representative of Krishna, and they're to be treated as good as God. Before spiritual masters, absolute, is order must be followed. Sure. Well, what's the argument? Spiritual master must respectfully present a different point of view, but in the end must respect his conclusion and give up one's own ideas. The best solution in this regard, just don't tell him too much of what you're doing, and just solve your own problems in the mood from, I don't really want to bother him, you know, with so many things. He's got a lot of things on his mind, and, right? I mean, it's not fair, you know, to expect that he can just micromanage the life of his disciples. So you get around point 4 in that way. Point 5, one must trust the spiritual master and be convinced that he always acts for our best interest. But still, you're careful, you know, in front of him not to reveal too much. Yeah? Rather not. 6, we must therefore follow his directions, whether he gives us an explanation with convincing arguments or not. So, yes, we cannot demand that he'll explain himself to us, even when he is saying, follow it, but, no but, it is ultimate. It can come to that, and it may come to the crunch. These things can happen maybe once in the spiritual life, or once in every so many years, but it can happen. Let's say, and now just accept this. No discussion. Which is very difficult for the Western mind. Prabhupada said about Western people, we are proof hungry. We always want arguments, we always want reason, we can't accept everything. But why and how? But wait a minute, no, but... And so on. Then 7 comes a part where I also say, well, initiation is not only a matter of entering into a formal relationship with a spiritual master, but also into a formal relationship with ISKCON. What is a formal relationship with ISKCON? Well, for one thing, it's recognized in ISKCON, and initiations give us a certain level of privilege in ISKCON and whatnot, and of course then there are certain expectations from ISKCON. It depends on, in the frame of reference, which you have in front of you on your handout, you can remember that there was ISKCON, institution, and congregation. And of course it depends where you are. If you're in the temple, then you'll feel it more. If you're outside the temple, you
you feel less.
It also depends on your mood. There are many standards of Vaishnava etiquette and behavior within ISKCON which one must learn and follow. Our spiritual master will guide us how to deal as an individual with an institution. It always remains a difficulty with in the relationship between individual and institution. Looking at anthropology, it will come up a little later in this slideshow and also in the course. We are looking at a paradox between the interest of the individual who has a desire for expressing his individuality free from the restrictions of the group, and at the same time, the dependence that we have on the group and our environment. So on the one hand, you can't live with them, and you can't live without them. And that is sort of, at least according to anthropology, the paradox that exists between individual and institution. Something to consider. Okay, then the ISKCON law comes in, and that's where I wanted the law book, because it's in ISKCON one must receive the recommendation of the local temple president for initiation. I also think you have to wait 1 year, and there are some other conditions for that. Couldn't remember, and I wasn't sure if it was 6 months or 1 year, and there is a test and all that. So, 13 questions. But I didn't write all of them because I wanted the law book. So, I'll edit it in the next presentation of this lecture. Just bear with me. The conduct and role of women in the Vaishnava society is very different than what we are accustomed to. Women may sometimes have to make adjustments that are difficult. So the guru will try to accommodate our individual nature, but sometimes we must be prepared to just surrender. The fact that we all make, men and women, make a big cultural adjustment when we come into Krishna consciousness. But in one way, women sometimes even more, because there's something of a Vedic model at least appearing on the horizon. It's no longer so much imposed, because, like, as I can see, the majority of the ladies present now is not covering their head, right? As is like as once in ISKCON, in the previous era, it wouldn't be allowed. Right? It just was not allowed. Once there was a time when a lady in the temple in ISKCON would not be allowed to walk around without her head covered. She would be pulled up. Right, arrested. All right. Pull her over. Show your license. Okay, get out of the car. What's going on, Brad? Driving without head cover. Okay, fine. Yeah. So, this was policed. This was not permitted in the earlier state of our development. So there are things to adjust, and even still, in the day of today, it may be difficult. Once we've taken initiation, this is a point which is important for me. Once we've taken initiation, we cannot take it back. The vow has been made, not only to the Guru, but actually to Krishna. The spiritual master is, after all, acting as the representative of Krishna. If after initiation, one engages in sinful activity, reactions are more severe than before. One can never be an ordinary person again, even if one tries to act like one. Then 12, you know, after all that heaviness. On a positive note, initiation is a great and wonderful blessing. Through it, we become transformed, and gradually the most wonderful love for Krishna will emerge from our heart, which can float the entire universe. I was reading a very nice letter which partially inspired me to write this paragraph, and it was a letter of from Prabhupada to Himavati. And Himavati, she had asked, it was in 68, she had asked Prabhupada a question at the end of her letter. So Prabhupada said, in regards to the question at the end of your letter, you are asking, where is the ocean of love? And Prabhupada said, know that the ocean of love is in your heart. Yeah. So that was pretty, a pretty amazing answer.
because I doubted that any one of us could have gotten it right. If I would have asked, where's the ocean of love? We might have thought of many things, right? Bhakti Rasa, Rita Sindhu, we might have, you know, tried to many, many different varieties of answers. The Prabhupada's answer is really like, it's completely on the spiritual platform, and it's completely very, very human and endearing answer. I liked it very much. And therefore, I thought the most wonderful love of Krishna, like from the ocean of love for Krishna, will emerge from our heart, which can flood the entire universe. So far, for the small letters we read in today, we want to read again. It is always good to have a look at other traditions because we can learn something. It's not only that we are the only ones who are taking vows in Christianity also. We'll first read what is here and then we'll start the discussion. So there are two categories of vows that are taken, namely simple vows and solemn vows. Vows are taken for obedience, chastity, and sometimes it's called poverty, or sometimes just the other words that will come up in a moment, which is to slip my mind. Whatever it may be, one can take simple vows, and simple vows are taken for a period of 3 years. They can also be extended. One can take them again, even up to 9 years. Simple vows are taken for 3 years and then can be extended up to 9 years. And of course, that's a trial period, mutual. After 3 years, they can see what kind of person this is. I mean, this guy could have saved himself quite some trouble if he would have let people in for 3 years, and we could say, well, thanks a lot, but I don't think we'll give you an extension on your visa. Sorry, you know, you'll have to leave the country within. I could imagine some nice varieties on that. You get a 3-year stamp in your passport. The management could do wonderful things with simple vows, right? 3 years, generally, the monks, of course, themselves could also see, is this what I really want to do with my life? After about 4 to 5 years, solemn vows are taken, which are taken for life. We read something about Benedictine monks, and some time ago, something I liked. It was a procedure where they take the vows, and their vow, they have to write themselves the vow on a scroll. After all, these monks are all learning how to write in these particular biblical writing styles, right? So they have to write a document, calligraphy or something like that, and they have to write this document themselves, where they write their vow. And the scroll is accepted by the priest who takes the vow. Then the bishop here, and then the scroll is taken and it's placed on the altar. So then the vow is offered. Then the name of the person is entered into the book. When they give him his, let's say, devotional clothes, then what they do is they take the carny clothes and pack them up very nicely and keep them with the name tag and everything. Now, if for some reason a person who's taken vows later on desires to give up his vows, it's possible, but then that person will have to, he doesn't get back his scroll, and his name is not taken out of the book. He has to give his devotional closing in, and it's nicely put away and packed with a name tag, and then he gets his carny clothes and he walks away and he goes back into the world, but the name is still in the book. kind of stuff. It's kind of nice. It's a nice procedure.
Of course, you know, our name is also still in the book, right?
As I mentioned in the conditions of the contract, it's still there. We cannot take the vow back.
The church, it is said, can relieve someone of his vows.
So it does happen that someone desires to give up his vows, and the church can do it according to the church. But whether that is a fact, that's the question. The church may claim that they can do it, but it's questionable. Because vows made to God, if you make a vow to God for life, then basically you cannot change your mind on it. So that is a problem for many people who do change their mind. So much from Christianity, yes?
So I said there's a difference that something they don't have in this stuff, and it's training and evaluating the vocabulary, and you think about it. It's very sad as well. But there's no training, there's no I read an article by Matthew about that.
Yeah.
And he talks about that, you know, it's like, it's people who are not mature emotionally, physically, and take baths without being trained or guided, and then you drop by chance. It's like a little responsibility. Yeah. It's risky, and then all the girls are
done
then because they were not prepared. Yeah. Maybe they were not fit to take that at this point in their lives, so I think it's have to consider that point of view.
Training and education.
Yeah, I think you are. I'm going to repeat here.
So she's bringing out the point that there is more training, one could say more preparation, than in ISKCON, in a sense, apparently. It appears like that. She feels that there is a great need, that this could, in many ways, benefit us, and so on. I'm not the best in remembering many points all at once, but that's the gist of it. She said, I hope that tomorrow we'll get more sound and we get a second mic for the audience. That would really help. And but today, just have to do it like this.
Yeah, so I think so. I think that we could, I think attempts have been made in more recent years. You know, there's much more awareness. We are even here in the light of that, but in the light of increasing our awareness. But with us, yeah, oftentimes people just walk in, yeah, and you're initiated sort of because you want to be, and partially because you hope, you feel like spiritual life is a great struggle, you really want it, but on the other hand, you also have a lot of doubts, and you feel the material desire is pulling very strongly, and you hope that the relationship with the spiritual master will sort of pull you out of that dilemma that you're in. Shall I stay a devotee or shall I bloom? I really want to be a devotee, and it's a daily experience or an hourly experience or something that even can happen every 5 or 10 minutes. 1 minute, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. Next one, I'm going to bloom. And one can go through these dilemmas in the beginning very rapidly, and even over the years it can still continue. But eventually, the fine line between spiritual life and blooping may also become less clearly demarcated, and it may merge a little bit, and it may not be so clear anymore when one is still in and when one is out, or when one. So that may be also there. So initiation is sometimes used like that to sort of pull us up out of a dilemma of doubt. That's not the best way to take initiation, because later on you find out that it's real. Right? Later on you really have to live with these vows, and then you are experiencing a lot of stress, and how you can do it. So therefore it's better to prepare more. So there is such a thing. In our culture, in our Vaishnava tradition, known as Purushottam, or it is described as we have to prepare. So traditionally, one has to prepare. And therefore, Prabhupada also started something that you have to first follow for a period of time and so on, and then you can be initiated. You must be recognized by senior devotees that you're really following it nicely and so on. And over the years, ISKCON leadership has tried to add more and more to it. It is interesting to look at the concept of simple vows. If you look at Vedic culture, for example, I looked at vows in the Bhagavatam and found a description how brahmacharis sometimes would take a vow to be brahmachari until 25. So I find that quite interesting. Right? They just say, okay, I'm just going to do it until I'm 25, and then I'll see again. Right? It takes the whole thing off the mental platform. So it looked to me like, when I read that, I thought, well, maybe we should introduce that, you know, some preliminary vows like that could help us. If we say, I'm just taking the example of a brahmacharya, but if we take a vow, okay, we take a brahmacharya and be a brahmacharya until 25, then everything is on the mental platform, because otherwise the brahmacharya ashram can be, for example, the most mental period in one's life. Shall I not? I like to joke about the buttons on the shirt of the kurta, you know, they have a purpose. Shall I not? You always sew an extra button. So this dilemma, this personal dilemma, one could get off the mental platform. So I think that's also nice. I'd like to point out that that in the church, at least we find it mentioned that celibacy was not necessarily always imposed as much as it is today. A case is made for priests who were married in previous eras in the church, and even for popes who were married. Critics, right, who are always to be found in this world, have mentioned in the Bhagavatam there is the forest of material enjoyment, and there are the crickets, you know. Here in Europe, you may not, at least in this part of Europe, you may not be so aware of this sound, but if you're in southern Europe, it's certainly there. In certain parts, what is being Indian, in India, you live forever with this. I can do it with my. I've heard this for so many years of my life that it's sort of still echoing in my head, the crickets. So, the crickets in the forest of material enjoyment are compared to the constant stream of criticism that is there. So, the critics are well known. Of course, there are two types of critics. There are critics who are unduly criticizing, and there are critics who are justly questioning. So I'm not criticizing the critics at all. Whether these popes were married while they were popes or married before they were pope, I leave it in the middle. But the point is, celibacy certainly was not carved in stone in the church. Yes, the vows to poverty, chastity, and humility were tough to follow, and many have given it up. They brought some friends with them. They are driving a nice car and drinking the wine, and the noses are there. We drop the commitment to poverty, chastity, and humility. So, off they go. And we go to Spanish. I put in a little translation for you. Open up to your imagination just for a moment. Think of well, where the mind goes sometimes when we in our mind are thinking about. about how it would be to give up our vows, because we are not always so faithful and chaste to our vows in our mind. Sometimes in the mind we are going to open up to your imagination for not too long.
Swami, Prabhupada's godbrother, who lived in India
And one day suddenly the army came, arrested him and put him in a concentration camp. And there he was, a Swami. But I'm a Swami.
This is a concentration camp.
So, what's the world going to be like? What are we going to be like? Is it realistic to take vows for a lifetime? If anybody feels well, I'll say something. Don't hesitate. Meanwhile, I'll push the next button. And the other day, Vasudev already mentioned the point because, of course, I rehearsed my lines a little. So he had something to say about it all. What did you say?
Suspended
between the borders of nature and code. I like that because it's a fact that animals don't do that. Animals are just basically, they let out whatever they want to let out in any place and time. It doesn't matter whether people are looking or not. They are not waiting for a bathroom. They just let go. They follow their nature. But we, in so many ways, are mixing culture and nature to a point where one psychologist said, so many layers of culture come on top of our nature and it gets drilled in from such an early stage that we can no longer ascertain what is culture and what is nature. Somewhere there's a line where we become confused. So here we see a paradox there between nature and culture. Many times my nature is rebelling against the culture. I don't know about any of you, it depends, but many times I feel suffocated, right? Like the culture feels like a shoe too tight, I'm out. And I have in my life also rebelled many times, and still doing it today, even by sort of with this seminar. As you notice, there is a rebellious upper tone every once in a while. Because rites of passage mark distinctions in an otherwise continuous life course, they celebrate and facilitate change or disruption of standard social categories, while at the same time they preserve them. Yes, okay, so change and tradition. Change. We are changing. We go through so many things and we are going through real changes in our life, and it's a real experiment, and yet there's some tradition also coming with us. The conflict between one's aspirations and strivings for individual ventures and yearnings for assurance and sustenance from one's social group. I mentioned it before. To be free, you want to be on your own. And yet, to have support, you want to be with them. In this way, we have this paradox. Yes. Can you speak very loud? You can.
Culture is gone because we all come from different countries, and sometimes I have a feeling like we have to suppress that culture and say, I'm not Israeli, I'm not German, I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm here, so I don't care about my country anymore, I don't care about my culture anymore, now I'm just like, now I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, so we come from different countries also, and in Israel, you know, we're not Israeli, not German, American, Indian, or whatever. We don't care about this anymore, but is that a fact? Well, I agree with you that it's not so easy to really become free from the culture of one's origin, because I experienced it myself that I lived in India for so many years, and then after many years I came back to Amsterdam, and I gave a lecture. And there were some Dutch people there, that was Amsterdam, and they asked questions. And they asked questions from like, well, you know, you're saying it's like this and this and this, but why would I accept that? You know? And I was thinking, wow, how Dutch, you know? These people are so Dutch, right? You know, saying this and this, why would I accept it? And then I was thinking, God, and I'm also like that. And then suddenly I realized that I was Dutch, you know. And all these years I thought I wasn't Dutch, you know? But I don't just accept it, you know. I mean, why would I accept that? I also totally am so Dutch, you know. And then I suddenly realized, thank God, I am Dutch. Real shock. So I thought that I'd outgrown it, you know, after having been away for some, I don't know, almost 30 years or whatever it was, and still Dutch, you know. So in one sense, we may be conditioned by the country of And it's not only cultural conditioning, it's also karmic. We take birth in a particular country because there is a particular spirit in that country which suited our mentality from previous life. Whatever state of being, of consciousness one has at the end of life, that state one will attain. So you were already Israeli in the last, at the end of last life, you had developed the Israeli mentality, and then poof, Israeli. Me, something attracted me to being Dutch. I don't accept it. The other thing of the weapon, I like it. Lotto et Averbo. I am struggling, I'm wrestling, and I'm emerging. Nothing in the world is going to keep me down. Just go Dutch, you know, Dutch again. I guess those things have also made me take birth in Holland. Some other things I really don't like. Maduro Dumb, yeah. All of Holland is like Maduro Dumb. And you may not know what Maduro Dumb is. It's a miniature city. You know? It's a miniature city which is like an imitation of a real city, and it's really well done. It's like you can see Maduro Dumb. It's very good. There's a church, and you can walk like a giant in Maduro Dumb. And actually, Maduro Dumb is a symbol for Holland as far as I'm concerned. The whole country is like Maduro Dumb. Everything is so small. It gets on my nerves. With all due respect to those who appreciate Holland, I do not need to. I know there are some Dutch people who do not mean to speak against it, but this is my feeling against Wolfgang in relation to my own cultural background. So, but we transcend it. We transcend it. The point is, we may still be influenced by that previous karma, by that previous conditioning, but we're not going to make a culture out of it. You know, I'm not going to. It's like I'm not going to make an issue to be Dutch. And it's like I'm proud to be Dutch, and great to be Dutch, you know, and I cut my door in half, right? Because in Holland, we cut the door in half, and I open the upper part, and then I lean, you know, with the open half, with the upper half open, I lean over my bottom half, right? To talk to someone outside. Now, that's traditional. What else, you know, so many Dutch things you can do, and so on. I'm not, we're not going to make it a culture that we're into it. We're into being servants of Krishna. And that's our meditation, how to become a servant of Krishna. But that doesn't mean that we can stop acting according to our conditioning. It's like we still have an accent, you know. We can try a different accent, but it is not really changing the mentality. We're really flying in terms of time and not in terms of the slideshow. So we have to move on. We are going to South Africa, where every step is dance. Or we see here a Spanish flamenco sitar kirtan mix with
past and it's still going on today, very cultural.
So here we are. We are, whatever we are a mix of many cultures. Okay, so that's something to consider. Now here I am presenting something else after all that culture. I want to go to my personal life, and this idea I didn't develop for this seminar. It's a little not very bright on the projector, but you can see it. Basically, I have been writing this in letters to some people because I developed this idea how I'm trying to balance these three aspects in my life, like a juggler is throwing balls around. And for me, three is already difficult. Some can do more balls, but I can do only three. And I have my personal well-being, mission, and bhajan. Right? Personal well-being, obviously, if that's not there, then it has hard to function. So, looking at varnashram, looking at health, looking at mental peace, looking at location, looking at association, it all comes to click a little bit. Otherwise, it gets difficult. It begins to eat at me. If I don't have good association, the one that inspires me after a while, I really have time to pack my bags. Of course, mine are always packed, so that's easy. But in other cases, when your bags are not always packed, time to move on. The mission, if there is no mission, then life, spiritual life, gradually becomes dry. So mission, of course, makes it exciting, you know, to really see that someone else is becoming a devotee. That's that we need. So preaching it, we have to, in some way or other, do it. There has to be integrity, and ultimately, preaching is from person to person. Remember how I mentioned that Kierkegaard story, 3,000 people converted in one day, but were they really converted? And that's the question. So therefore, it has to be from person to person, and it has to go real and deep. So, if we are having only mission and personal well-being without bhajan, then it's hollow. Then it's hollow. If we have only mission and bhajan and no personal well-being, then it's burnout. And if we are having only bhajan and personal well-being, then it's just slowly drying up. Then we live in the desert. Then we lose eventually our taste to a bhajan. We are living, bhajan and personal well-being could be like, my house is a very, very, very nice house with two cats in the yard. And so on, and it's then a very sweet life, and also Krishna conscious, you know, we have everything so nice and so tasty, but still, it's just not exciting enough. Satisfaction is the key element in spiritual life, and the question is where to find it. Tapas will tell us.
You have to maintain our Krishna consciousness for our whole life, and Krishna is explaining in Bhagavad Gita that only by higher test. So we have to find satisfaction on different levels, intellectually, mentally, socially, in Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, if we feel we have a lack of something, for example, everybody needs friends and some interaction with friends. So then we have to find that in Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, you will have to get that need from outside. But then you get material association.
I think that's enough. We don't want to go too far. So in the Bhagavatam, there is a verse that speaks about the shoes of satisfaction. For a person who has suitable shoes on his feet, there is no danger, even when he walks on pebbles and thorns. For him, everything is auspicious. Similarly, for one who is always self-satisfied, there is no distress. Indeed, he feels happiness everywhere. So the shoes of satisfaction are important. You may look at your frame of reference. Realization comes on the level of transcendence and on the level of goodness. So it depends.
depends where you are. If we are at the level of goodness, we need no satisfaction in the mode of goodness. We can't just be satisfied with transcendence if we are not on the transcendental platform. Then we need some satisfaction in the mode of goodness. If we are transcendental, yes, then we find all of satisfaction in transcendence. And since most of us are not purely on transcendence, we do need some satisfaction in the mode of goodness. And therefore, Thomas' point was right. If you need friendship, then we better make friendship with devotees. Otherwise, we start hankering for friendship outside of devotees. So, there were some good points made there.
Just to maintain the Shastric perspective really quick of ourselves, our relationship with Krishna, and of the world around us. These three areas, what you look at, ourselves, the relationship with Krishna, and the world around us. Then, aham brahmasmi, I'm not the body but eternal spirit soul. Jivira sarupai, Krishna nirjadas, all living beings are the eternal servants of Krishna. And the bigger picture, looking at Mahavishnu, looking at Radha Krishna's spiritual world, and looking at all the universes coming from the body of Mahavishnu. I mean, looking at the greatness of the Lord.
Everything in our life is so insignificant and small. So that's important that we regularly remember that helps.
Here we are looking at
a few monks.
And you can, if you look carefully, they're all seated in a sort of a yoga posture, and one says, one is sitting on the grass quite relaxed. And one says to him, I used to be a young, crazy rebel just like you, you know. So, it's interesting because who is crazy? The one who's sitting on the grass like that, or the ones who are sitting in the yoga posture?
Who is crazy? The ones who are fanatically and artificially practicing their spiritual life, or the one who is just a more real and natural human being, who is crazy?
Here is Pandu Vijay.
He is cutting the grass and he is living in a monastery. And he has just written on the grass, God, I am bored. Yes.
So a monk living in a monastery, God, I am bored. Again, the confined lifestyle of living in the narrow walls of vows. And Nietzsche was pointing out, he said, in the name of religion, man denies himself the few things that he can enjoy in this world.
Nietzsche, the Antichrist. Not that Nietzsche is the Antichrist, by the way, he was writing about the Antichrist.
Again, about the confining nature of Krishna consciousness, being sectarian. We had in Amsterdam one member of the congregation who used to say, you may not be a sect, but you definitely behave like one.
And this is quite good.
Right? We are always very eager to point out,
we're not, we have our roots in India, but
we behave like a sect in so many ways, and from that point, we are sectarian.
And sectarian also means, in a sense, that we are imposing a very artificial, narrow lifestyle upon ourselves.
Are we behaving sectarian means, are we really allowing ourselves a way of life?
Remember, culture is not just all about cultivation, but also as a means to express desire. In other words, a way of life which is satisfying to us. So there's a challenge here. Religion in modern times, as Wilford Campbell Smith observed, is an addendum to human life, an extra appendage to our ordinary activities. Dharma allows no separation between our religion and our life. This free modern concept of religion is ISKCON, that all absorbing self-contained character that disturbs so many. It is also exacted that non-compromising spirit which created these things are going on.
Authenticity, it's a long story which we're cutting short. Basically, in the beginning, our faith is weak. We may have faith in Krishna consciousness, but is it really me? Is it, can I do it? Then we sort of decide, I'll do it anyway. We jump forward. One becomes swept up in the rapids of a total change of lifestyle, which may carry one years ahead in time before one comes to question consciously, who am I really? And not just, what am I supposed to be? In the beginning, it's all about living up to a standard. But with time, that alone one survives. Stronger and stronger, the need arises for authenticity. That is the point. So, with time, we have a stronger and stronger need to be authentic, to really feel natural in the life that we live. We cannot just live with beliefs. We must be natural. For a long time, we can live with beliefs. But after some time, we must feel naturally at home in the life we live if we want to survive without. So, here we speak about the different areas which are Shastra, about history, psychology. It's what we've already been discussing. And the conclusion then of the seminar will be a review based on this model of the funnel of reflection, which asks us questions. What did we actually learn? What did we discuss? So what? What does it mean to me anyway? Now what? Now what am I going to do with this? So this is the reflection funnel which we are looking at here. We'll look at this again at the end of the seminar, in the last day. Then we will look at our experience for the week, and I hope that we will discuss today. It's the first time that I ever shown this this PowerPoint. I had no idea how long it would take. Now I know it takes long. But with this, it's finished. And with this, the time is also up for the day. I was hoping to do it in half of the time, but I was not. It was not so. So that's what happens if you do some topic for the first time. Your timing, you have to find your timing. So that I invited you though to partake in discussion. You didn't do it so much. Maybe I didn't draw it out so much. But in the next few days, we will, in a more structured way, discuss all these topics. How do we look to pass? And I hope that with that we'll get a good look at ourselves. That we'll become more realistic and more determined, more strong in our dedication to take advantage of these paths, so that we can go back, that we can go in the express lane back to Godhead. Thank you very much. There are some of my class comments, or if anyone would like to comment something.
It's left observed.
Yeah. Shall I think the mic might reach.
I can't talk.
Huh?
I don't hear you.
We cannot hear you.
I can try, okay. I left a point.
Like
But then I'm going all the time, and I don't know how much I should. But, yeah, we can start with it. I think that it comes back because, as you can see, we are discussing all these things. We'll make a note of what you said. Yeah, but I'll just make a note so that I will remember it. And I'll say one sentence. First, what a good idea. So now, we are not following. Well, you know, you can say that Srila Prabhupada began this movement, and he began the transplant from east to west. And he started the movement with many young people. They were all 20, 25 at the most. They were practically all were unmarried. Even when I first became a devotee, the majority was all like an ocean of saffron with a few spots of white. Yeah. And now it's an ocean of light, you know, and it's like we have two, you know. Yeah. I mean, that's quite something to have more than one. And then, of course, you know, there's a few sannyasis in the world, but it's like nothing. So the culture has changed a lot. Now we have all these age groups. Right? Certainly at age 53, you know, things are not like the same to me as they were at 23. Right? I really, you cannot give me the same idea of how I should live my life. So there are also age considerations now, so it has become much more complex, the situation, the variety of people that we're dealing with.
No, I mean, specifically the formal relationship
Yes, so the guru relationship is also there. The guru is our absolute authority. And the day that we surrender to the guru, basically we give over independence to the guru. But if you're a guru and everyone's given up his independence to you, you want a peaceful moment. Yes, okay. Is it authorized if I go today to, you know, to this and this place? No, that's fine. No, you really can't do that. Okay, yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Yes. Thanks, Paul. Yes, hello. So, a guru cannot control the life of his disciples in all details. A guru, the disciple offers everything to the spiritual master, and then the spiritual master gives back independence to the disciple according to the maturity of the disciple. And that must be there. So, although we are surrendered to guru, we also have a lot of independence at the same time. Now, Prabhupada gave us he gave us teachings, he gave us philosophy, and he gave us some sort of model of, well, some information about Vedic culture. Vaishnavism, he began something, but he also said that we had to fill it in, and it wasn't completed. 50% of my work is completed, Vaishnavism is not completed. So there's a lot to still. Financial not completed is also a way of life. So we need a way of life also. So we cannot just see it so black and white that just because now we are in an era where we are questioning things, where the movement is no longer so autocratic, that is the fault. I think if we look in the next few days at these models, we could make a list on the flip chart of the advantages and disadvantages of both the eras to get a better perspective on your point. But it is noted. It's a very good point. I mean, it's a real discussion. So thank you for bringing that. I think Lucas, my last word. Yeah, there's nothing. It's your time, isn't it?
Real actor, keep going.
Can you speak more loud? progression or a digression? I say that there are is the transfer from theo-autocratic to Renaissance progression or digression? Is it going forward? Is it going down? Both. Say there are elements of digression and there are elements of progression, and that's what will become clear when we do that exercise that we were just talking about. Now, Abhinanda will has arrived, and I think we should just hand over the floor. Do you need a projector also?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, that's great. Then we just shut it down. Thank you very much.